Hello, I'm Mark Stein, and welcome back. I remind you, as we jump into our conversation here with Tom Dunkel, that Taste of the Arts, a benefit to support arts experiences in Maryland schools and communities, will be held on Friday, April the 19th, 7 to 11 p.m. at the American Visionary Arts Museum. Visit the website at yamd.org to view a complete list of participating restaurants, artists, honorees, partners, and sponsors, and learn more about the event and get tickets as well. We will be there. You'll be there. Joining us in the studio is Tom Dunkel. Tom Dunkel has written this book called Colorblind, The Forgotten Team That Broke Baseball's Color Line. And Tom, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Mark.
And we just discovered that we knew each other from before. We had dinner 7 or 8 years ago, and I said, this guy looks so familiar. That's why. Welcome.
Thank you.
So Tom Dunkel is a writer, an award-winning freelance journalist. He's written for The Washington Post, Sports Illustrated, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, many other places. Lives in D.C., drove all the way up here to talk about his book today with us here. So first of all, how did you find this story?
I actually had worked at the Baltimore Sun at one time as well. And in 2000...
You and 5,000 other people.
Yes,
all
exactly.
By now.
In 2007, I left the Sun and I went back to magazine work. And I was researching a magazine article. I believe it was on aging, of all things. And as reporters do, you get on Google and you start searching. And suddenly it's like following a trail of breadcrumbs and you come across something else. And I came across an obituary of a ball player who died at age 103, and his name was Ted Radcliffe, played in the Negro Leagues a long time. And I thought, a ball player that dies at 103 must have some stories to tell. So I read his obituary, and then I was drawn to his Wikipedia entry, and there was a one-sentence reference in Wikipedia that he had played for an integrated baseball team in Bismarck, North Dakota, in the 1930s. I know enough about baseball to know what April 15th, 1947 was. It was when Jackie Robinson broke the color line for Major League Baseball. So I thought something was going on in North Dakota at that time that I didn't know about and most people must not know about. So I dug into that story a little bit more and discovered, of all things, that Satchel Paige was on the same team in Bismarck, North Dakota. And at that point, I knew something was really going on in Bismarck, North Dakota, and I investigated it more and more, and it turned into a book.
It's an amazing story. I mean, the fact that Satchel Paige played for this team in Bismarck, North Dakota.
One would not expect, yeah.
An interracial team in 1932?
Yeah.
But from your book, it was also that their biggest rival, Jamestown, they integrated before.
Jamestown brought a couple of just parenthetically, this is that whole layer of baseball that doesn't exist anymore. We still have the major leagues. We have the minor leagues. There was that layer of what was generically called semi-pro baseball, but an overlapped professional baseball in a way, in that these were very good ball players. These were not guys taken out of the local bar and playing a beer belly softball. This was serious hardball. It got very competitive out on the Great Plains in North Dakota. A lot of money was being bet on these games, and there was a lot of pride at stake between towns. Essentially, these were almost like collegiate rivalries in football between these towns. And in 1932, Jamestown brought a couple of players from the Negro Leagues. And keep in mind, this is Depression time. The Negro Leagues, like a lot of businesses, were having financial difficulty. So it was possible to lure people away, particularly if some of the teams were not making payroll. So Jamestown brought a couple of players out. In 1933, the gentleman who's kind of a pivotal character in this book is Neil Churchill, who manages the Bismarck team. He takes the team over in 1933. He had actually managed it from 26 to 29, burned out, gave up managing for a couple of years, comes back in 33, and this time jacks the team up to a higher level. And originally he started to match what Jamestown had done. But then he took it to an even higher level by getting number one, more players. He eventually evolved into a team that was half black and half white. But also the caliber of players. Churchill had played semi-pro baseball himself when he was younger. He was a catcher. So he knew baseball. And he was also a hell of a salesman. He was a car salesman. And some people said the best salesman they'd ever seen. And he obviously did a very good sales job to get Satchel Paige to leave the Pittsburgh Crawfords and come out to Bismarck, North Dakota in 1933. Paige was the fourth black ball player at that time that he brought out to Bismarck. And then he kept building the team until the 1935-36, they hit their real peak.
The interesting thing about – there's so many interesting pieces to this, but one of them is that, first of all, Bismarck, North Dakota, at North Dakota, there were barely 400 black folks in the whole state.
Yes, correct. 1930 census.
I mean –
there was 377 African-American. Actually, they were called Negroes back then, right, according to the census terms, out of 680,000 people. Yeah.
And 50-some in Bismarck.
46.
46.
According to the 1930 census. 46. Yeah, out of 11,000. So it was a small community. You know, we joke, but in those days, there were towns in North Dakota where people had literally never seen a person of color before. The exception, of course, would be Native Americans. They were out there. But in terms of seeing an African-American, there was people who had never seen them before. And it was there was a young woman who grew up in Bismarck at that time. She was told how people would actually touch her hair and look at her palms because, you're talking largely Russian and German stock out there.
We have to take a short break. We're going to come right back and continue our conversation, jump into Satchel Paige and more. Colorblind, the forgotten team that broke baseball's color line, and interesting stories about Satchel Paige and more coming up, so don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with Tom Dunkel about his book, Colorblind, The Forgotten Team That Broke Baseball's Color Line. If you ever thought there was a weirder thing than having the first integrated interracial baseball team in the history of the United States of America in Bismarck, North Dakota, well, we're here to talk about that this hour with Satchel Paige, the greatest pitcher of all time playing in Bismarck, North Dakota.
This is true.
So I love the Satchel Paige story. So they get Satchel Paige to come because the guy who started this team, Neil Churchill, calls Abe Saperstein, the man who started the Harlem Globetrotters. And he asked him, how do I get, who's a great black pitcher? Well, he would have said a Negro pitcher.
Yes.
That I can get. And he talks to Abe Saperstein, and Saperstein says back to him, that's easy, came the reply. Satchel Paige. In fact, he's the best pitcher, period. And thought he couldn't take him away from the Pittsburgh team, which, in fact, he wanted to get out of.
Gus Greenlee was the owner of the Pittsburgh Crawfords, and he was a character in his own right. And he and Satchel came to loggerheads, as Satchel often did. He was the original free agent, although that wasn't the term for it back then, a free agent and a free spirit. So in 1934, in the summer of 1934, he and Greenlee are having a bit of a falling out. And Neil Churchill swoops in. He gets a phone number from Saperstein to get in touch with Satchel Paige and does a heck of a sales job and gets him to come out to North Dakota. Greenlee was not real happy about this.
Gave him more money and a Chrysler.
Yes, he did. He threw in a Chrysler. He was a Chrysler dealer. So he threw in a sweetener there. And Satchel hops on a sleeper train and goes out to Bismarck, North Dakota. He arrives on August 12, 1933. He pitches on August 13th, 1933, and strikes out 18 men. He pitched against Jamestown that day. There was that first game, you have to realize that these are small populations out there and beautiful old little intimate ballparks, but they were filled to the gills. Paige's reputation certainly preceded him. So they had an excess of 3,000 or 4,000 people for these games. And again, keep in mind, there's 11,000 people in Bismarck. I think Jamestown was about 8,000. So you're getting a quarter more of the population out to these games. And a fierce rivalry continued through the end of that 33 season. Actually, Jamestown and Bismarck had five games towards the end of that August-September stretch. And Paige, once he got out there, the team went 14-0-2 after Satchel arrived. And then he left in 34 for the back to the Crawfords, jumped back, and then 35 jumps back to Bismarck for the entire season.
On the way to the championship.
Yeah, there was a first ever national semi-pro baseball championship tournament held that year in Wichita, Kansas. And it was a double elimination tournament with 32 teams, so it stretched out over 2 weeks of baseball. So it's almost nonstop baseball every day. And it was an interesting, the person who was the director of the tournament was a bit of a P.T. Barnum showman in his own right. So he brought the elite semi-pro teams, of which Bismarck at that time was considered one of half dozen or 10 of the top teams. But he also seasoned that with some kind of oddball teams. He had an all-Japanese team out of California. He had an all-American Indian team out of Oklahoma. And he had an all-brothers team. I mean, literally, all brothers.
Biological brothers?
Yes, yes. This was the Stanczak family out of Waukegan, Illinois.
Of course they were from Waukegan.
Yeah, well, poor
they
Mrs.
Had to be.
Where else would
you get?
There to
where
do
else
it?
Would you get all those brothers?
And poor Mrs.
Besides
Stanczak.
Utah.
Yeah, poor Mrs. Stanczak.
Don't make me choke on my coffee.
He missed that one. Besides Utah.
Yeah. So they had this essentially double elimination round robin tournament, and it was quite controversial. It was major league scouts there because this was again there was some elite players there. So more than a dozen major league scouts there.
Who were they called it? This is what in this interracial teams, the major league scouts came. And they called it ivory hunting.
Ivory hunting
because they were looking for white players only.
That's all they could sign. Yeah, that was the
and Satchel striking everybody out.
Right. Satchel actually struck out 66. Players during the course of this tournament, and that's a record. This tournament is still going. It's evolved into a collegiate tournament, but that record still stands, his pitching record from that summer. He won four games during that tournament.
So, amazing.
So talk about this. I want to talk about a couple of characters here. Then I'm going to talk about Satchel Paige and why they feared him coming to Bismarck.
Well, first of all, his name is Satchel. Like, find another Satchel in Bismarck. Yeah, that's
many.
Not going to happen. I love it.
And we talk about the they had to save the white women when he got there. We'll talk about that in a minute.
They had to save all the women from Satchel.
All the women.
They had to put him in a special place. We'll get to that.
Well, thank God him and Jack Johnson weren't there at the same time.
Oh, my God.
There would be no white women left.
No white babies. Quincy, if you see, come on, that's why he comes here in 2 seconds.
Sorry, I apologize. Let's
apologize.
Stay focused. This is
Quincy great. Troop.
Yes.
Catcher. Who met Satchel Paige on the field and blew Satchel Paige's mind, they both end up on this team.
Yeah. Quincy Troop is sort of the young, represents the young, innocent side of baseball in this story. He was 20 years old at the time when he left the Chicago American Giants, which were
also part of the Negro Leagues.
Yes, out of Chicago. And he was 20 years old, so he wasn't getting a lot of playing time. He was a backup catcher. Very good ball player. 6'2", 215, 220, a very big man. So he wanted to play more. And Churchill put the word out through Abe Saperstein in Chicago. So Quincy Troop gets on a plane in late June of 1933. He becomes the second black ball player that Churchill brings out. He precedes Satchel by about a month. And Quincy... His description of baseball is so sweet back then. He said it was like a mother, father, and brother all rolled into one. I mean, so he's playing for the love of the game at that point. And right before he goes out there, the Chicago American Giants played in Pittsburgh against the Pittsburgh Croffers. They played a doubleheader. The second baseman for Quincy Troop's team was hurt that day, so Quincy played second base for this doubleheader. In the second game of the doubleheader, Satchel Paige pitches. And the second time up, Troop gets hold of a knee-high fastball and puts it over the right field fence. It went about 400 feet and ricocheted off a hospital.
Nobody did the Satchel Paige.
Yeah, that Satchel sort of stood there staring in disbelief as this young guy circles the bases. And then as serendipity would have it, that night everyone goes, Gus Greenlee owned a bar, restaurant, grill in Pittsburgh. Where
he was a character in Pittsburgh who, from the black side of town, works way up from being a shoeshine to becoming owner of the team. That was somebody else.
Yeah, that was
St. Louis.
That was in St. Louis. But he came up from the streets as well, and he's actually kind of a Robin Hood figure in Pittsburgh. He gave a lot of money to the NAACP.
His name again?
Gus Greenlee.
Gus Greenlee. I've heard the name.
Yeah. Oh, he's a character. He was like Paige. I mean, these were not.
These are good Jeopardy questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Great Jeopardy questions.
Who is Gus Greenlee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, point being, that night, Paige and Quincy Troop meet up at Gus Greenlee's little restaurant. And Satchel, of course, who's the guy who hit the home run for me? I'll never forget your name, Quincy Troop. And then he gives Quincy some advice.
Oh,
it's very avuncular.
Yeah,
he said, don't be a know-it-all. Lay off the liquor. and stay away from the women, which were all bits of advice that Satchel himself didn't take, he was willing to share with other people.
He knew his own mistakes and said, don't do what I do.
Exactly.
We're going to come right back to this conversation, and we're going to tell you how to, so don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Reminding you, on our way back to our conversation, the Mark Steiner Show is sponsored in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's national foreclosure settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We are here with Tom Dunkel. The book is Colorblind, The Forgotten Team That Broke Baseball's Color Line. One of the things that struck me about this also was the period of time, and we can talk a bit more about baseball in that period and what was going on. But the racism that took place in that period was even in places like North Dakota, where there were no black folks.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw it in you write about what people wrote about the players in the newspaper. You write about the kind of epithets that came out of the stands, the fact that people like Satchel Paige and other players, black players, could only live in certain places. They couldn't go out to the hotel at night. They couldn't go to places. So even in North Dakota, that was a big piece.
It's an odd dynamic out there. The KKK was around out then, but the KKK was picking on Catholics in North Dakota. The situation with the black players was quite interesting. Hilton Smith was another player on that team who's now in the Baseball Hall of Fame. He's a pitcher as well, not as well known as Satchel. He described playing out there as being in heaven. I mean, the town was very welcoming of these players, but they're a curious dynamic because, and this is not meant pejoratively, but African-American ballplayers in that time were something of a curiosity. Again, some of these people had never seen a black person.
I must have sent you my thoughts because in their mind's eye, some of them had nowhere to place their racism.
Yeah, they're wrestling.
So when they finally got one, they were like, we've got one, and we're going to hammer this one.
Well, no, be fair to them.
And I'm being facetious, but most importantly, I think, again, you said it's a curious predicament, and it sounds like it was because part of them were more intrigued and more fascinated than there was racism. And
it's very interesting.
There was a dance that they probably had to do.
And it's part of a learning process in a way.
Sure.
It gets very interesting down in Wichita, if you want to talk about that in a moment. But in Bismarck, the players, there was only one hotel, a working class hotel that would accept black guests. So there was little problem finding a place to live. There was a small black community where there was a couple of rooming houses, and Churchill was able to find accommodations for people. They could not get served a meal in a restaurant. You would have to go to the back door and get essentially takeout. But now here's the odd dynamic. Quincy Troop, young guy, comes out to Bismarck, North Dakota. In August of 1933, they hold a Quincy Troop night at the baseball park. He was helping the Little League kids in town, and he was a hugely popular figure in Bismarck, as were all the players. So there was that push and pull dynamic going on within Bismarck, but the town very much embraced the team. The business community got behind it and were donating all sorts of prizes in the person who hit the first home run of the season or did this and that. And it was a source of pride for the town. Now, as you get further outside of Bismarck, that's where it would get a little uglier and a little nastier. There was an Italian-American player out of Chicago by the name of Joe Desiderato who played third base
for
that team.
You write about him a bunch in here.
And he said, I heard stuff and saw stuff that people shouldn't have to tolerate. And
as an Italian American?
Well, no, referring to his black okay. teammates. And again, here's a guy out of Chicago, very good ball player, and there was very good semi-pro ball in Chicago. He'd never had a black teammate before. Obviously, Satchel Paige had never played a white teammate before. So it was a lot of recalibration in a lot of people's brains going on out there at that time. But as they got, when they went out on the road, there would, even in Canada, they played tournaments up in Winnipeg and in Saskatchewan. And it could get nasty up there with the crowds. Now, one of the players, Ted Ratcliffe, on the team, said there was some death threats. I'm not entirely sure if that's not a little embellishment there. But there was certainly the racism. Now, when they get down to Wichita, it got very interesting because the scouts, Major League scouts there was a dozen of them, actually met with the tournament director, and to a man, they said, we're not comfortable having an interracial team here. The director of the tournament also had invited, and to his credit, brought four all-black teams to that tournament in 1935, which was shocking enough for the community of Wichita, Kansas. But to see an interracial team was very uncomfortable. And there's a columnist for the Wichita Eagle, a guy named Pete Leitner. And you read his columns, and you can tell this guy, the wheels were turning in his head. He was having trouble figuring out how to process this and what he was talking about. Blacks, they can take the heat. You know, it was real hot that summer. So they can take the heat better than the white players.
Just to hear this banter and try to make sense out of nonsensical content like racism, which is a social construct, to try to see them reconcile that over a game with a ball and a bat is baffling still today, because it was a sport. It was there for entertainment. It was there to bring some positive morale to communities and family nights. It was all such great intentions behind the sport. And then to see all of these social dynamics played out.
But that was one of the few places where black and white communities were actually doing some crossover back then.
Right, and
that's
my
baseball.
Point as well. Yeah, that this was a space where it was all about fun and entertainment and family. And then,
but there was a lot of thinking going on there. In fact, to this guy's credit, the team comes down and plays in 1935 and 1936 at this big tournament. In 1936, and again, Leitner is wrestling with this, talking, and again, the colored boys, that, you know, that's sort of, you know, the vocabulary back then. But Quincy Troop gets a fan letter sent by somebody in Wichita during that tournament. And Pete Leitner, the columnist, who sounds not the most enlightened guy in the world when you read his columns, said,
You're so PC, I love that. Enlightened guy.
But he says, I think you need to read this letter. He actually printed it in its entirety in the paper. And this guy, the spectator who wrote this letter was saying, you know, I watched Quincy Troop playing here for 2 weeks. I saw him get hit by a pitch in a key situation.
Right.
No mouthing, no lip. He just goes to first base and goes about his business playing ball. He said, the guy's a gentleman, he's a good ball player. And this is literally the quote from the letter. I don't care if he's, you know, black, white, blue, purple, whatever. He's a ball player and a good man. Yeah. But this guy, the columnist from the paper, is clearly, his own thoughts are being played out in print. It's very interesting to watch that. And when he later dies in 1960, he was covering the Summer Olympic trials out in Palo Alto, California, and there's a small plane crash on the way back, and he dies. His last column for the paper, for the Wichita Eagle, he was literally counting how many white and black athletes were on the Olympic team. I mean, he's still wrestling with this 25 years later.
And there was another, going back to Satchel Paige, when they were trying to figure out what to do with Satchel Paige, and Satchel Paige had this chrysler and found his way to this place called the Dome, the hippest of the speakeasies in Mandan, North Dakota.
Mandan's across the river from Bismarck. I mean,
how many hip places could they have? He made a connection with a cab driver who was delivering moonshine, and so and Paige liked a good time. So he said, Quincy, I don't know how to put it, what I'm about to say to you, but it's about Satchel. The fans are really wild about his performance, and so am I, but there's one thing I'd like to talk to him about, Churchill stammered. I understand that a man has to go out with a woman, but there's a way to do it in any walk of life. And Churchill eventually got to the point, just tell him to be careful about riding white girls around in broad daylight.
Broad daylight. A broad and broad daylight. Wow.
Satchel.
Satchel.
So, you know, this is, well, we're going to take a break in a minute. When we come back, I wanted to talk a bit about some of the other stuff that happened in this team, what happened afterwards, the other teams they played, the state of baseball in that period, but also about Satchel Paige's run-in with early drug-enhancing use of baseball to make his game better.
That, oh, really?
Organic doping.
Wow. Is there such a thing?
Well, you'll find out. We're going right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way back to the program, I'll remind you once again, as we did at the top of this hour, one of our guests here today helping us pitch and to get you to support the BEA is Stacey Sanders-Evans, Executive Director of Young Audiences. And they have their annual Taste of the Arts, a benefit to support arts experiences in Maryland schools and communities. It'll be held on Friday, April the 19th from 7 to 11 p.m. at the American Visionary Art Museum. You can visit their website at yamd.org for a complete list of participating restaurants, artist honorees, partners, sponsors, and to learn how you can get tickets to that event. And it'll be great. We're going to be there ourselves. It's going to be a great evening. So back to our conversation with Tom Dunkel, his book Colorblind, The Forgotten Team That Broke Baseball's Color Line. Now, this one little part of the book just kind of stuck out at me. I was reading this piece, and, you know, we knew that Satchel had a penchant for, he loved his ladies. And there was this woman that he ran into who came from the Rez, Dorothy Running Deer.
Running Deer. You think she was from the Rez, Mark?
Well, she was from the Rez.
I'm being facetious.
Standing Rock Rez. And Satchel Paige liked to fish.
Big fisherman. We love fishing.
Go and great fishing on the Rez, down the river, catch trout, all kinds of good stuff. But he went down there with Ms. Running Deer. Met her daddy, who raised rattlesnakes.
This is what Satchel said, yep.
Right?
Which sounds a bit nonsensical.
No, it doesn't. It makes sense to me. Yeah, it makes absolute sense to me.
Yeah, it does.
Just parenthetically to set this up, Standing Rock Indian Reservation, which borders North and South Dakota, is where Sitting Bull was repatriated after Battle of Little Bighorn, and Custer left from Fort Lincoln, which is about 4 miles south of Bismarck, North Dakota. So there's this whole historical intertwining out there. Satchel's story was that he goes down to the reservation and her daddy was raising rattlesnakes and starts chatting. And he says, you know, what happens if you get bit by one of these? And Mr. Running Deer says, well, I got a jug in the house of this anti-venom, you know, medicine I use.
That came out of this venom from the snakes itself.
And so Satchel said, well, you know, what would happen if you put that on your arm? And he said, well, I wouldn't recommend it because it's too hot. Whereupon Satchel says, please give me a jug of that so I can take it with me. And he winds up using this to massage. He was not a hypochondriac, but he would take two scalding hot baths every day to take care of his arm. And he started rubbing this stuff on his arm. And he actually kept doing this even years later. And this story sounds a little nutty, right? So I tracked down a young woman who's still alive, who's out in North Dakota, and she said, and she's Native American. And I talked to her brother as well, and I said, oh, yeah, we remember our aunt and uncle used to talk about Satchel Paige coming out to the Indian reservation all the time. So he never divulged what the ingredients were, and this was all sorts of speculation on that. But he carried this this jug and this gunk with him for years after that.
And he said when he first put on his arm, here's the quote from your book. He said he rubbed a few drops on his bicep, his right bicep. Nerve endings that he didn't know he had screamed for relief. He quote was, it's one of my arm didn't fly out of the room. Page said. But by trial and error, he learned how to dilute Running Deer's concoction. It became part of his post-game muscle massage ritual.
Wow.
And whatever happened, it worked because he just played the best games after he did it. And this was the original doping, rattlesnake doping.
So, you know, now it's going to be a whole phenomena. Let's run out to, what is it, Standing Rock Res and see if we can find the Running Deer family and hook us up.
Get
a
that
concoction.
Recipe.
Yeah.
So there we are.
There's a fortune to be made.
It's intriguing. Yeah.
With Satchel Paige, in all of these stories, what's intriguing about him is there's always a thread of authenticity to it. And if I may, I'll give you another example of that. When I was out in North Dakota reporting this story, I met the daughter of another player on that team, a guy named Bob McCarney. And she told me this story that there was a player on another team who had said something to Satchel that he didn't care for. Some kind of racial remark.
Right.
And that he said, I'm going to get this guy. And that later on in the game, this other guy was... The way the story was told me, he was running to first base. Satchel's pitching. He throws over the first base and get the guy out. Throws the ball into the runner, and the runner breaks his arm. And I'm thinking, nah, this can't be true. This sounds. When it's going to be one of those apocryphal stories, it's just too good to be true. Going back through the microfilm, reading the accounts, I come across the game in 1935. And what this was a player who was on another team the year before who had said there had been some trash talking out there. In 1935, this player joins the Bismarck team very briefly. And the player, the father of the woman I was referring to, happened to be drunk the day of the game. He normally plays first base. So this other player, who had just joined the team, plays first base for Bismarck. And Satchel is pitching. And sure enough, during that game, there was a little slow roller hit back to the mound. And he threw over to first base and led his first baseman right into the runner. And what happens? The guy, he dislocated his elbow when he's carted off the field and never played again that year.
Wow.
And anybody who knows Satchel Paige, he never threw a ball not knowing where it was going.
One of the things about this book, though, a couple of things I want to get to before we end the segment, is the picture. This is the only thing that exists, only picture that exists of the team.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
This on the front page of your book. Yeah. And you have the white player with his hand on the shoulder.
Moose Johnson.
Moose Johnson.
I love it.
Vernon was his proper
with
name.
With his hand on Satchel Paige's shoulder.
Moose was from Crystal Falls, Michigan. Which was iron mining country.
And had his hand on Satchel Paige's shoulder.
Yeah.
On the cover of this. And so the beauty of this is almost mimics the Pee Wee Reese, Jackie Robinson picture.
Yeah.
Where he put his hand around.
Actually, there's not a picture of the Jackie Robinson. We know it happened because it was reported. And Pee Wee and Jackie Robinson, of course, were allowed to talk about it. I have a postcard of that picture of the 1935 team over my desk at home. I've been staring at that picture for four and a half years while I was working on this book. It was only till about 2 weeks ago, and this doesn't say much for my perception, but the light bulb suddenly went off, and that's a really cool picture of the Bismarck team. What about? Well, it's essentially a precursor to the story of Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson. And this, very quickly, the story was early in 1947 when Robinson comes up and joins the Dodgers. They're playing in Cincinnati, and Jackie Robinson was getting all sorts of death threats, and other players were sliding spikes high to him and this and that. And Pee Wee Reese in batting practice walks. Pee Wee Reese played shortstop, a Kentucky gentleman, walks over to Jackie Robinson, who's playing second base, and put his left arm around Jackie Robinson's shoulder, which was signaling both to Pee Wee Reese's teammates that, hey, I accept this guy, signaling to the people in the stands and in the country that I accept this guy. Well, that picture of the Bismarck team where you got Moose Johnson standing next to Satchel Paige with his big paw of a right arm on Satchel's shoulder is kind of foreshadowing what would happen a dozen years later.
Tom Dunkel, I'm going to thank you for the book, Colorblind, the Forgotten Team that Broke Baseball's Color Line. Fascinating piece from American history we never heard before. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, Tom. This was an intriguing conversation.
Well, thank you, Michelle.